The scripture reading this evening, which is in accordance with the message, is from John, the 20th chapter, verses 30 and 31. And many other signs truly did Jesus in the presence of his disciples, which are not written in this book. But these are written, that ye might believe that Jesus is the Christ, the Son of God, and that believing ye might have life through his name.
We have visitors here with us again today, as usual. We're glad for your presence. My wife's mother and father are with us on many more occasions than I make note of to you, because I know that your parents are also here at various times, and we don't know about that either. But we're always happy to have our mothers and fathers and in-laws, and we're glad that you're here if you're here visiting with us today. We have some former students who are back, Portia and others, who've come back to be with us. It's always good to see you again. I'm not sure I'm going to be able to get... That apple didn't have anything to do with the sermon tonight, the apple that was on the table. The vice that you see on the table, I know it has something to do with it. I think the vice reminds me of a note that a preacher had in his notes when he had out there beside a weak point. He said, "Weak point, shout here." And I think that vice may be one of those such shoutings that I'm trying to illustrate, perhaps something that I'm not really capable of getting across to you in words. We want to express appreciation to Terry Smith and to Dan Woodruff, my brother, for providing us with pretty well a needed break for you on the last two Sunday evenings. And they've brought us very interesting lessons and refreshing lessons. But we're going to get back into the theme that we've been in for the last, last semester and this semester. The theme for the entire Sunday evenings of the two semesters from September or all the way through to May, the theme has been developing our abilities to communicate Jesus Christ to a lost and unbelieving world, to develop our abilities as representatives of Jesus Christ. And that's what we're attempting to do. Last semester, we studied a series from 2 Corinthians. Now, I hope that you remember that. We were in it for about 3 months. We talked about our task in general, as we talked about the four words that control that section of 2 Corinthians: being, having, knowing, and working together. Being, having, knowing, and working. These four words that control that section, and they also control our growth as Christians. But this semester, we're turning from the general and are turning to the specifics. We're going to be talking about how to strike up conversation with strangers. We're going to be talking about how to go about finding common ground with them. Probably before the semester is open, we're going to be talking about how to make communion bread, how to worship in your homes, underground. We're going to be talking about a lot of things that are very practical, that are down to earth, and are very specific. But the more I study the subject of how to communicate Christ to an unbelieving world, the more I'm convinced of a certain kind of evidence that I've got to talk to you about. I've been announcing it for the last 6 weeks, and every time I get up to it, I go around it, and something else seems to be pressing that needs to be done and said. I feel there about like the young man that said, "Behold, I come," preaching one day, and he couldn't think of the next point, and he backed up and said, "Behold, I come," and he could not think of it. He said, "Behold, I come," and the whole thing fell over and fell right in the lap of a woman sitting in the front seat. And he said, "Oh, me, I'm so sorry." She said, "That's all right, honey, you warned me 3 times. So I've warned you for about 6 weeks that I was going to speak tonight on self-corroborative evidence. Self-corroborative evidence. And you say, "Well, that needs warning. what in the world is self-corroborative evidence? Well, I want to give you three illustrations, and then I want to give you two examples, and then I want to develop a third and illustrate that. The three examples that I want to give you to show you what self-corroborative evidence is, I want to show you three mechanical illustrations of it. You see your jaws, your two jaws? Your jaws are self-corroborative in their mechanical action. Did you ever think about how difficult it would be to eat if you didn't have anything but just an upper jaw? You know, what would you do? How would you chew? You can't. But because of God's wisdom in providing self-corroborating action in your jaws, you're able to get a hold of a piece of meat and chew it up and digest it. That's because you have self-corroborative action here in your jaws. This is self-corroborating action, the action between your fingers and your thumb. In fact, there was a Russian couple that in the book Tortured for Christ by Richard Wurmbrand, he tells about two Russian sculptors, a man and wife, who actually came to believe in God simply upon the basis of what they call the God of the thumb. The man told his wife, he said, "I would have believed in a God had there been nothing in the way of evidence other than the design of the hand." He said, "Therefore, I believe in the God of the thumb." Well, that's self-corroborative. Do you ever think about picking up anything if you didn't have a thumb to be used as the backdrop for it? That's where this vice comes in. A vice, can all of you see it? I went up way up there and looked, and I know you can't pretty well, but that's a vice there, and it's a self-corroborating mechanical device. And what it means is that it has a backdrop that's immovable, and it has a foreground piece that is movable, and you get the immovable approached by the movable, and you get something in between the two. And by the way, you've got what we might call in religious terms conviction. You've got the thing where it can't get loose. Now, the more I study and try to determine how we're going to go about converting people and convicting them and bringing them to faith, I'm convinced that we're going to have to be aware of and be able to present what we're going to call tonight as self-corroborative evidence. So much of our evidence in terms of Jesus Christ finds itself going like this. It never does meet. What I'm after tonight is to see if we can't, first of all, understand the principle. Do you understand the principle of what I'm talking about? Do you know what I mean by when I say self-corroborative evidence? It's the evidence that meets. It comes from both directions, connected to one block like this. It's connected at one place. It comes from different directions, and it finds then us in the middle of this evidence, and we can't get away. That's what John was talking about in John 20, verses 30 and 31. Many other signs Jesus did in the presence of his disciples that are not written in this book, but these are written that you might believe that Jesus is the Christ, the Son of God, and that believing you might have life in his name. Now, these things that John was talking about in John 20 and 30 and 31, they are the movable part of this vice. These things were written that you might believe. And here he backs them up against this backdrop. And we're going to study that in just a moment in a bit of detail. But let me make some illustrations, or let me give you some examples of what I mean when I say our testimony concerning Jesus Christ must possess that kind of evidence. Now, let me be completely clear with you. We're confronting a world of people who do not in any shape, form, or fashion believe that Jesus is what he claims to be. It is going to be up to us to push them into a corner. It's up to us to get them in a position to where they're going to have to make a decision. We're going to have to force them into a crisis. We're going to have to get them in this corner and force them either to confess that Jesus is the Christ or deny him as an imposter. We're going to have to force them to consider four alternatives. He's either a liar, he's a lunatic, he's a legend, or he's Lord. One of the four is true. And if we don't come to be able to present people with the evidence that will finally force them over the cliff of conviction and press them into the corner of conviction, we're not ever going to be able to do anything other than just simply kind of play at religion and come together and console each other in our failures to communicate Christ to an unbelieving world. Now, this awareness of this kind of evidence has been coming upon me over the last two or three months, perhaps the last two or three or four years. But it's beginning to focus, and the last two or three Sunday nights before the break with Terry and Dan, I spoke to you on two particular subjects, and I want to call those to your attention. And for those of you who are visiting with us, about all I can do is just simply state them and try to give you just a very fleeting glimpse of what we were trying to do. Do you remember the sermon from Daniel, the 9th chapter, verses 24 through 26, where Daniel dealt with the 70 weeks? Do you remember that sermon? Daniel said that from the time of the going forth of the proclamation to rebuild Jerusalem until the coming of the Christ would be 69 weeks and then another week, he said. And then he gave the detailed description of what would take place, how long it would be that the city would be rebuilt, how many weeks of years after that. And we came to the conclusion that Daniel was stating that 490 years after the edict by Artaxerxes to rebuild the city of Jerusalem, 490 years after that, the Christ would come. And the word in the book of Daniel 9 and verse 25 or 26 is the word Christus, ho Christos. The Christ would come, the anointed one would come. Well, we looked at that, and I want to simply say tonight that that's one of the areas in which we find some self-corroborating evidence. Now, let me give you some other, just one more illustration. Did you ever see a laminated beam? A laminated beam is made up out of perhaps 1x4s, and maybe 10 or 15 of those things are put together, and they're clamped all along in whatever shape the architect wants them clamped. They're glued in between and clamped together with one of these self-corroborating devices. Now, and these clamps are found all the way along that laminated beam. And if they're clamped hard enough and left long enough, then the clamps can be taken off, and that beam of wood, having been put together by laminated strips, that beam becomes, and it stays in that shape. Now, I've found that there are various areas or various blocks of evidence throughout the Bible that, when taken into consideration in and of themselves, contain within themselves evidence that comes from two directions. I hope I can get this across to you. This one in Daniel is like that. For example, in the Bible, you have Daniel's prophecy back in the Old Testament scriptures. Daniel 9, 24 through 26 says that the Christ would come 490 years after the edict to rebuild Jerusalem. All right? In some more of the Hebrew writings, 490 years later, we find that there were men coming claiming to be the Christ. None at the time specifically that Daniel spoke of, except Jesus Christ. Jesus of Nazareth came during that period of time that Daniel specified as being the time when the Christ would come. Now, in total, there were some 64 Christs that came in a period of time immediately preceding and immediately subsequent to the coming of Jesus Christ. They were frauds and forgeries, or forgerers. Jesus Christ said, everyone who came before me is a robber, and everyone who came before me is a robber and a thief and a robber. But he came at the time when Daniel said that the Christ would come. Now, what I'm saying is that self-corroborative evidence is evidence where there is this immovable backdrop. That's what we have in Daniel, the 9th chapter. Daniel 9 had been sitting there for some 490 years, just sitting there. Sitting there, historically, sitting there. It had been known and read by the Jews for 450 some odd years. So we find that Daniel 9 is this back part of this vise, and it sat there unmovable for over 450 years. All right? Then there came this man in the time that Daniel said he would come, and sure enough, he came. So, in one sense of the word, Jesus Christ proved to be historically consistent with the Old Testament prophecies regarding the time of the arrival of the Christ. Now, if all you can do is put this in your mind and start thinking about it, that's good enough for tonight. Just put it back in your mind and say, well, preacher, I don't quite understand what you're saying, but I'm going to turn it over and I'm going to chew on it a while. Think of Daniel 9 as being this immovable backdrop. Think of the coming of Jesus Christ as being this part that comes in. And sure enough, when the final 490th year, or the exact year that the Christ was supposed to come, when you look then at Daniel and try to find out, did someone come when Daniel said he was supposed to come? Then, to your utter surprise perhaps, but to your gratification, you find out, by the way, there was a man who came at the very year that Daniel said he was going to come. All right, that is self-corroborating evidence. It's all found in the same book. It's substantiated and validated by secular history also. You're not just dependent upon one book in this case. The historical accuracy of the coming of Jesus Christ can be validated from historical sources other than just sacred. They can be validated from secular sources as well. So that's at least one of these vices that we're going to put around this lamination of evidence. And we're going to have it all glued together. We're going to screw it together. That's one. All right, look again. Jesus Christ not only fulfilled the time prophecy of Daniel, but Jesus Christ also fulfills the personality prophecies of Exodus and of Isaiah. Now, do you remember the next Sunday night I spoke to you on the biblical view of the cross? You remember how I told you, and we will look back at Exodus, the 34th chapter, and notice there the nature and the personality of God. Jehovah, Jehovah, a God merciful and gracious, slow to anger, abounding in steadfast love and faithfulness, keeping steadfast love for thousands, forgiving iniquity and transgression and sin. You remember that? We talked about the personality of God as displayed here in Exodus the very first time that he told people what he was like. That's what he said he was like: loving, forgiving, long-suffering, faithful, all of these things about himself. And then we turned over to Isaiah, the 53rd chapter, and we found there the projected personality of the Messiah. The projected personality of the Messiah is that he would bear our griefs, carry our sorrows. He would be smitten by God and afflicted. He would be wounded for our transgressions, bruised for our iniquities. Upon him to be the chastisement that made us whole. With his stripes we are to be healed. All we like sheep have gone astray. We have turned everyone to his own way. And the Lord has laid on him the iniquity of us all. He was oppressed. He was afflicted. He was brought as a sheep to the slaughter, and as a lamb before his shearers is dumb. All of this was the projected personality of the Messiah. Now, you add this then to the other one, the time prophecies of Daniel. Jesus fulfilled that. That's self-corroborative. Then add to this the personality prophecies. What is Jehovah going to be like? What is the Messiah going to be like? Well, did this one who came at the time that Daniel said the Christ would come, did he have any discernible personality traits? Oh, yes. He even put himself out on a limb to the point that he claimed to be Emmanuel, that is, God with us, and he claimed to be the Christ. He claimed to be the Messiah, that is, the anointed one. This one, now watch, this one who came at the very time that Daniel said the Messiah was going to come, that one who came 490 years later, he came claiming to be the Messiah, and he came claiming to be Emmanuel, God with us, but that's not enough. There were 63 other men who came claiming to be the Christ, but they didn't have what it took to put up or shut up. They had to shut up because they couldn't put up. When you look at the personality of Jesus Christ, you're going to see that he was in personality the very thing that God described himself as back in Exodus 34, and the very projection of the personality of the Christ in Isaiah the 53rd chapter. Now watch how all of this evidence keeps building. In my mind, I can't get away from it. I'm not a Jew, but I am a man who is cognizant of certain facts of history. I cannot dismiss certain evidence concerning the Christ, especially when it has to do with this man, because his claims are so stupendous. I look at the prophecy of Daniel, and I look at the fulfillment in the time that Jesus lived. He fulfills the time prophecy. That's self-corroborative. I look at the claim that he came being Emmanuel, and that he came claiming to be Messiah. And I then go back to the Old Testament projection of what the Messiah's personality was to be. And I look at the description of Jehovah to Moses back in Exodus 34. And then I come to weigh Jesus of Nazareth, who fulfilled Daniel's time prophecy, who came claiming to be the Messiah and Emmanuel. And then I put him in the balance to weigh him to see whether or not he had the right personality. And sure enough, when you weigh Jesus Christ and his personality in the light of what Jehovah says he was and what the Christ was projected to be, we find that, well, that's exactly the way this man, that's exactly his personality to a T. Long-suffering, merciful, kind, faithful, giving himself for others, sacrificing himself, being all of this, you see, that's exactly the way that the Christ lived. That's his personality right down the line. That's another one of these clamps in this laminated beam. That's another one now. That's two. And tonight I want to just talk to you very briefly about a third. But these two examples of self-corroborative evidence, I'll mention them again as we go along in other sermons, but I want you to see your jaw, your hand, this vice, Daniel's time prophecies, Jesus' fulfillment of it, that's self-corroborated. The projections of the personality of the Messiah and Jesus' own personality, it fits together just like a hand in a glove, that's self-corroborative. And then finally, not only was Jesus Christ consistent with the Old Testament time prophecies, not only was he consistent with the Old Testament personality prophecies of the coming Messiah, but Jesus of Nazareth was consistent with himself. He was consistent with himself. Now listen, in the New Testament, the gospel records present two kinds of evidence concerning Jesus Christ. One of these kinds of evidence is that which is obviously true. That kind of evidence in the life of Jesus recorded in the Gospels that is evidently and obviously true. You couldn't deny it if your heart wanted to. The poor widow standing there and heard him say that a man's life or a woman's life doesn't consist in the abundance of the things that she possesses. That widow knew that was true. It reached down and filled a vacuum in her life. It said to her, yes, Jesus rings true. When Jesus says, love your enemies and do them good and don't hurt them but pray for them. When they heard that, that's true. It's hard to understand, and yet our very most innermost nature says, you know, that's right. As you would that men should do to you, do that to them. Your own head, your common sense tells you, you know, that's the right way to live. That's right. Love your neighbors, you love yourself. Oh, that's right. That's right. And on and on. In fact, there's a statement here made by a man in the book called Treasure Chest. He says, if you were to take the sum total of all the authoritative articles ever written by the most qualified of psychologists and psychiatrists on the subject of mental hygiene, if you were to combine them and refine them and cleave out all the excess verbiage, if you were to take the whole of the meat and none of the parsley, if you were to have these unadulterated bits of pure scientific knowledge concisely expressed by the most capable of living poets, you would have an awkward and incomplete summation of the Sermon on the Mount. Now, all he was saying was that the things that Jesus Christ taught are so obviously true that if you were to get all of the latest scientific evidence about mental hygiene and about how things really exist in life, that if you were to get all of that, discard all the rubbish and all the excess out of it, put it all together, condense it down into one little short statement, all you would have would be just about what Jesus Christ said on the Sermon on the Mount. Now, it's that kind of evidence that I'm talking about when it comes to Jesus Christ. Things that you know are true. Things that you know in your own heart, your own conscience bears witness to it and says, Lord, I know that's true. That kind of evidence is produced and presented in abundance throughout the Gospels of Jesus Christ. But there's a second kind of evidence. Those things that are beyond proof. The things that you cannot prove. His claims. He claimed to be Jehovah on earth. John the 8th chapter. Before Abraham was born, I am. He claimed to be the I am. He claimed to be the bread of life. He claimed to be the resurrection from the dead. He claimed to be the light of life. He claimed to be all of these various things. I am this. I am this. I am. Those things are absolutely astonishing to think that he would have the unbridled audacity to state things that would put him on an equality with the very God himself, to where the Jewish people, they took up stones to stone him, because not only did he call God his father, but he said, not only did he break the Sabbath, but he called God his own father, and he claimed to be before Abraham was even born, and they charged him with blasphemy. The miracles that he did. Seven signs in John plus the resurrection. He raised the dead. He opened the eyes of the blind. He healed the lame. He turned the water to wine. He walked on the sea. And there are two others I can't think of right now what it was. He fed the 5,000. These evidences, these signs, you didn't see them. What are you going to do with them? John says these things were written that you might believe. Well, how am I going to use these things that were written that I might believe? Written miracles don't move a man to faith. They move him to doubt. Something that you just hear somebody else tell about what somebody else did that's so completely outstanding and out of the ordinary, that doesn't move you to faith. It moves you to doubt. You want some proof of that? In this John the 20th chapter, when Thomas was not with the disciples when Jesus appeared to them, listen to Thomas as he has reported to him the resurrection of the Lord. When they went to Thomas after having seen Jesus, they said, "Thomas, we've seen the Lord." Thomas said, "I will not believe that. Who in the world are you trying to kid? I'll not believe it until I put my finger into his nail prints, until I put my hand into his side. I'm not going to believe it." Now, that was his reaction to what you might call ear evidence. He just heard it. John recorded those miracles. It has the same effect that it had upon Thomas. These that are recorded for you and me, it has the same effect when it's written down that it had upon Thomas when he just heard it. Written down evidence or heard evidence. What is the word for? I can't think of the word, but anyway, it means that you hear it. Huh? Well, hearsay. What was? Auditory. That's good enough. Anyway, heard. That's better. We've got enough long words that you introduced another one. All right. Auditory. But it has the tendency to push you to unbelief. Well, what is it then that catches you where you can't move? Now watch. Do you know what would happen to this vice here if it didn't have that backdrop? If all it had was that front part with that handle on it, you know what you could do? And it had this long screw that went from here to New York? Well, you just screw that thing all the way to New York. Sure you would. You know why? Because it doesn't have anything to stop it. Well, you know what you're going to do if all you had was the miracles of Jesus Christ? You'd be screwing all the way to New York. There wouldn't be anything to stop you. My question tonight is, and what I want to see if we can't understand, what in the world is it that stops a man that whenever these unprovable things keep being applied to him, that he simply says, oh, I can't get out of that. Ouch. That brings me to either have to deny him or accept him. Now, what is it? It's these two kinds of evidence that the Gospels present. One, which we'll call the undeniable. His teachings, his personality, his life, all of these things that people had to say, you know, people that are possessed with demons don't talk like this man. Somebody had said, "Why don't you just dismiss him? Why are you listening to him? He's got a demon." Oh, somebody else said, "No. Mm-mm. People that are possessed with demons don't talk like this man." Now, that's that backprop. Here they were presented with a claim. Here he is claiming to be the Christ. And they said, "What are you listening to him for? He's possessed with demons." But there was that immovable backdrop. They couldn't get away from the fact that this man just didn't talk like other men. He just didn't talk like people that were possessed with demons, and he had to be reckoned with. That's the kind of evidence that I'm convinced exists all the way through the New Testament, all the way through the Gospels, all the way through the rest of the book, all the way through the Old Testament. I'm convinced that there is one after another and dozens after dozens of such self-corroborative groups of evidences that force both Jew and Gentile to a crisis in his conviction, to where he either has to say, "I believe that the man was a flagrant imposter," or else, "I'll just have to admit I cannot get away from him. I believe he must be what he claims to be." Now let me close with an illustration. 3 years ago, I met a young man named Eric Steinhauer here in Searcy. We were over in Jack and Jerry Davis's house in a Bible study one night. And this man was cycling on a bicycle through America. A very fine specimen of a physical fitness. He had been influenced by some Christians overseas from David Lipscomb College. They had influenced him to come to America, to bicycle through America, to see it, to come by and see the college. He did this. He ended up in a Bible class with us one night. We reasoned there with him for about 2 hours. I didn't see him again then until a year later. He knocked on my front door one day and said, Mr. Woodruff, I'm Eric Steinhauer, and I recognized him, and we set up an appointment to get together that night to talk. I knew he was not a Christian. I knew he'd been influenced by Christians. But this man, as we sat in to talk over in what is now the basketball boy's house over on Center Street, we sat there in one of those rooms and talked for probably 2 or 3 hours. I tried to find out where he was and where his faith was and where he was in his faith. Listen to this very interesting confirmation of what I'm telling you tonight. This young man told me, I asked him point blank, I said, Eric, where are you in your faith? He said, well, let me tell you what has happened. He said, some months ago, he said, I was bicycling through America. He said, I had come to the place in my atheism, my unbelief. I had come to such a point in my life that I was beginning to be unable to tell the difference between reality and fantasy. I was beginning to come to the place where I could not actually tell the difference between truth and fable. Now, he wasn't talking about just in things that he read. He was talking about visible things, desks, bicycles, streets, roads, people, food, that he was beginning to not be able to discern between the illusionary and the real. Now, that's getting pretty close to a complete mental breakdown when you can't distinguish between reality and illusions. Now, that's where he said, I came to be. And he says, I was riding down the road one night, and he said, I finally made a decision. He said, as a last resort, I said, I will take the teachings of Jesus and I will check them out in my life. I'll put them to the test and I will see what comes out. And he looked right at me and he said, Mr. Woodruff, I put Jesus Christ and his teachings to the test. And he says, I found that Jesus of Nazareth is right 100% of the time. I have never found him to be wrong in a single thing that he taught that I could test. Well, I'll tell you, there we sat, this unbeliever and me as a believer, and hearing him tell how he came to believe that Jesus Christ knew what he was talking about. But the boy never had committed himself to Christ as Lord. He never had been baptized upon his faith. And I asked him then, I said, but Eric, then, if you believe that about Jesus, why have you never been baptized upon that faith? And Eric said, I don't know. Well, we kept exploring and I kept prodding. And I said, Eric, what do you think about the miracles of Jesus? Then it came out. He said, I don't spend much time thinking about the miracles. I thought, Watch what he had done. He had discovered this immovable backdrop. He had come across that thing head on, and he couldn't move it. He said, you know, he's right 100% of the time. You can't move him. But when I asked him about these unprovable things, he said, oh, I don't spend much time with that. And I said, all right, sir, I know exactly where you are in your faith. I said, until you reckon with these miracles, until you reckon with that which is not just out of the ordinary, but until you reckon with that which is above the human into the supernatural, until you reckon with those things that you cannot prove, you never will be baptized. Because you see, baptism makes sense only if Jesus Christ is God among men. If he's just a philosopher, you can forget about being baptized. If he's just a good teacher, all you need to do is take those teachings of his that are true and dismiss his claims. Don't worry about his claims. But if he's the Son of the living God, when that God who walked on earth among men says to you, if you believe in me and are baptized, you'll be saved, only then will you move. And he sat there and looked at me and he said, you know, that's exactly where I am. He had not yet come to examine the unbelievable in the light of the undeniable. But now listen, I believe, and I think you see, that it's at that juncture where the unbelievable, his claims, his miracles, the things that John says here were written that you might believe that he's the Son of God. It's at that juncture where those unbelievable things are brought to bear against the undeniable things that you have this overwhelming, overpowering, self-corroborating evidence that produces conviction. Now, do you understand what I'm saying? Do you understand what I mean? When the unbelievable is brought to bear up against the undeniable, just like this vice being cranked up against that unmovable part, when you get the unbelievable cranked up against the undeniable, and you get people's head in there, I think not until then will we ever move anybody to genuine faith sufficient to cause them to say, I believe that Jesus Christ is the Son of God, and then live their lives accordingly. I think any other approach to it simply produces people who never have really genuinely come to the kind of faith that requires, that Christ requires of us. I hope you see this. We may have to go over it again some other time, but this is all the time we have tonight. Where are you in your faith? Have you come to those things that you find in Jesus' life that are undeniable? Oh, and there's so many of them. There's so many of them that are just undeniable. And that serve us in the sense that a hand serves a glove. We've got each one of us in our being. We've got an empty space way on down in our very being. And these undeniable things of Jesus, they fit down into there just like a hand fits into a glove. You know good and well that he's right. Just like Eric knew that he was right. Is that where you are tonight? Have you come to that admiration of Jesus as being a man? You know, by the way, he's right. He's right. To the place that he could say, and you know it's true, if any man hears these words of mine and does them, he'll be like a man building his life on a rock. And your very life cries out and says, he's right. I've tried him. I know he's right. What about these signs that John talks about? Raising the dead, walking on the water, healing the sick, whether he's present or not present, whether they're alive or not alive, doesn't matter. All these things that are superhuman, that are supernatural, that claim him as being divine. Have you reckoned with those yet? Oh, I don't really spend much time on that. You're going to have to, because if he was not what he claims to be, he can't be just a good man. He's a liar, or he's a lunatic, or he's just a legend. Somebody just made him up. But until you've reckoned with the evidence, you're not going to know whether he's one of those three or whether he is in truth Lord. If you're here tonight and you're not a Christian, think about this evidence. You may not live till tomorrow. We don't often and always direct the messages of this congregation to the lost outside. But if you're out of Christ, you're lost. If you're here tonight, and I don't guess you are, but if Eric is here tonight, you need to respond. And if there's somebody that's kin to Eric or like Eric, who's considered Jesus but never has really got down to the crux of the issue where you've been convicted of the deity of Jesus Christ, you need to respond. We extend the invitation to you. If you believe that Jesus Christ is the Son of God, step out in this aisle and come forward and say, I do believe, and I want you to baptize me right now into the name of Jesus Christ for the remission of my sins. And we will. The invitation is yours. You come while we stand and sing.